the Edsa revolution that was taking place. Of course, we've now got his son, who's now president, actually, I think, doing a very good job. But the Philippines is a country of approaching 120 million people now. It's an economy that pre-pandemic, for the decade leading up to the pandemic, was averaging about 5.5-6% GDP per annum growth. Pretty impressive. It's now back on that same treadmill, doing the same thing, 5.5-6%, just pounding it out every year. Coming off a pretty low base, but 120 million people. It's still growing. It's got what we call a demographic dividend. Unlike other countries in the world, this is a country that keeps producing children, and they're increasingly educated, and the middle class is growing. Now, if you're an airline as well, the other thing to sort of think about, and it's perhaps a little bit about where our focus is, it's clearly an archipelago. Actually, it's about made up of about 7,000 islands, three principal island groups. So getting around within the country, it requires air travel. And actually, it's perfect for an LCC. And actually, that's where our focus is. We don't get sort of sexed up about going to long-haul big destinations. Our principal focus is about serving the domestic market. About 70% of our seats are in the domestic market, flying people between the islands. And last year, we flew 24.5 million passengers. The pre-pandemic, we were about 22.5, so we broke through the pre-pandemic levels. This year, we'll get, depending on how engine availability is, we'll get to about 28, 29 million. So again, a lot of growth. First quarter of this year, we grew about 25%. But the Philippines, I should say, is a happening place. It's got a lot of people, increasingly educated, increasingly wealthy. And the one thing that's finally happening in the Philippines, and I've been there almost 10 years, is that the infrastructure is coming. It's, for many of you will have been to Manila and the traffic jams there. I mean, this is a sprawling metropolis. And I remember the first time I was there, it was chaos. I remember the one time I went home from the office, and it's only about 5 miles from my office to where I was living at the time. And it was, the one time it was 4 hours. The next night I was in the same traffic, and I said to my driver, I said, I'm not doing this. So I actually got out, I was dressed pretty much like I am today, chinos, brogues and a shirt, not a tie, of course. And I ran home through the traffic. It took me about half an hour, but better than 4 hours. Now it's changed, the infrastructure's coming on, and the infrastructure, more importantly for an aviation point of view, the infrastructure's coming on in terms of the airports, and that's great to see, which is why we are growing now more aggressively than we've ever grown before, and why we did a large order last year of, you know, up to 152 narrow bodies on top of the fleet that we already have. So that's a little bit about, I kind of waffled through that, a little bit about the Philippines and a little bit about Cebu Pacific, just a little bit more maybe specifically on Cebu Pacific. So we're now 99 aircraft in total. 12 or 13 of those aircraft, it was 12 a couple of days ago, I think it might be 13 now, are long-term AOG due to engine issues. We fly the GTF on our narrow body jet, so that, I'm sure everyone is aware of the engine issues. That, by the way, it's not just not in Pratt & Whitney, it's across the board. Engine issues, OEM issues are everywhere. But it's in total about 99 aircraft. We do fly ATRs. You might wonder, why on earth do you fly ATRs? Aren't you an LCC? Well, actually, we are an LCC, and we're very true to the LCC principles. We think that flying people around on short sectors are very simple, safe, secure, reliable, convenient, affordable service is what works. And it works perfectly for somewhere like the Philippines, where affordability is key, growing market. Absolutely fantastic. So why the hell do we complicate ourselves by flying around in ATRs? Well, there's some destinations in the Philippines where the runway is just that short that you can't get a jet into it. So we did have a fleet of 15 ATR 72-600s. We recently acquired a small airline called Air Swift, which has got some ATRs as well, which takes us up to about 28. That company now gives us access to El Nido. If any of you have ever been to the Philippines, the place which is the picture book, the picture postcard of places to go is El Nido, but of course there's lots of others, and a lot of those are served by the ATRs. Now we've got about 66 narrow-body aircraft, which is a combination of A320s and A321s. Two-thirds of those are NEOs now, still we've got a third of them are about CEOs. But why 320s and 321s? Again, we'd all be 321s if all of the runways were long enough and strong enough to take an A321. Some of them can only take an A320. And then, heaven forbid, we complicate it even further because we have A330s. We currently have 11 A330neos. Now, a quick quiz for anyone. Anyone want to guess how many seats we've got on an A330neo?
459.
440. 459. There's a prize. Another bottle of port for the man at the back. 459 seats. So this is as big a short-haul bus you can have. And the key there is we use it for short-haul. Now, why on earth would we do that? Well, Manila, coming back to Manila. Manila is one of the most slot-constrained airports in the world. It has been spilling demand for the last decade and will continue to spill demand. But if you think about it, one A330neo for us flying on short-haul routes is the same as two A321neos. And that's how valuable it is. Now, it also serves a few long-haul routes, but they're few and far between. LCCs in long-haul don't necessarily work. All right? Anyone who comes in and says, I'm going to set up a business solely LCC long-haul, then, you know, that's not the investment to make. Some routes work, but certainly plenty of them don't. Now, we found out the hard way. We lost money on a number of routes because originally that's why we got the 330s. And we stumbled onto the fact that the 330s could be used in the short-haul environment by luck. Sometimes good strategy is just luck, right? Just be lucky. Yeah, don't necessarily overplan it, just be lucky. So anyway, we have a very, very mixed up fleet for various reasons. But actually, our principal strategy is pure LCC. I'd love to think that we are as pure LCC in terms of our approach to things as Michael O'Leary. Now, nobody's as good as Michael O'Leary. I mean, what he's done has been, it's extraordinary the success he's had. But he has kept to his knitting. He flies short haul. There's loads of money to be made flying to the East Coast of the USA, but he's not interested because he's got so much opportunity sticking to his knitting. So we stick to our knitting. We generally fly within a 4-hour radius of Manila. I call it 4-hour radius of Manila because the statistics I'm going to come up with in a minute is kind of, it hits you. There are, within 4 hours flying time of Manila, 2 billion people. So, I mean, that's a big enough addressable market for most people, so we don't need to go much further. So when I look at what Cebu Pacific's about and look where the opportunity is, Philippines is a great opportunity. Get domestic right. 120 million people, vibrant population, let's do that right. And then if I look around the region, within 4 hours flying time, 2 billion people. And it's perfect for an LCC. These are all emerging markets, or a lot of them are, obviously up to the north. Northern Asia, some of them are not, but so that's what we do. We're very pure LCC, but we just happen to be complicated in terms of our fleet selection, because in order to deliver the LCC proposition, we have to do that. But just a couple of other stats to throw out, and then James, gosh, you don't even get to answer me one or two questions in this session, I think. Yeah, but to show that we deliver to that, we are 58% domestic market share in the Philippines. Just to show that's what we want to do. So we're rigorous. By the way, we don't play for market share. We don't target it. Market share is an output. We don't sit there and go, hey, we must get to this, we must get to this. But if you do things right, your market share goes up. Pre-pandemic, we were about 52%. We're now 58% because the other guys haven't been able to grow so much. And that's what we do. And this year we'll grow anywhere between 15 and 20%. From where we were last year. I say 15 to 20%. There was a day when you'd be able to sort of say, I'm going to grow 17.2% or whatever the number would be. But there is so much variability in your fleet these days because of the complexities of the situation that's being thrown up by OEMs, MROs, all these things that you have to manage the difficulty or the uncertainty of not knowing quite what your fleet's going to be 1 month to the next. In fact, quite what your fleet's going to be 1 day to the next. Just before I came into this event, I had my COO sending me one of those lovely messages. By the way, he's one of these guys, he's a brilliant guy, but when I get a message from my COO, my heart sinks. Yeah? This was one of those messages. Said, just to let you know, it looks like we lost 3 engines overnight. Yeah, so that's That's the sort of stuff that you have to deal with. Anyway, James, I'll pause there.
Speaking about cricket, there's a couple of questions I'd like to ask. I'd like to talk more about the fleet, but something you said struck me then, the catchment area, 2 billion people. I'm interested to hear what you think, or who you think, is your main competitor. Are you competing against PAL and AirAsia, or are you competing against ferries? How do you see your main competition?
No, well, all of those, actually. Some of them are ferries, so some of the routes you'll target will be purely a ferry operator, particularly now in the Philippines. In Manila, there is competition. Our market share in Manila is probably about 52%. If I go outside of Manila, it's close to 75-80%. So outside of Manila, the only competition we have, we're now five bases, in a number of those bases will be just ferries or buses. And that's a great place to be in, because once you can convert the passenger onto an aircraft or an airline opportunity there, then they tend to come and they tend to stay. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the ferries, but I think most people, once they've experienced the air travel opportunity, then they will stick with it. But yeah, the others are competitors. I do think, I mean, if I could distinguish between those two competitors that you mentioned, so I think PAL went through its own Chapter 11 experience. I think they did a very successful Chapter 11. I apologise for any lessors out there that were creditors and they went into it, but it was successful in the sense that they, you know, took $2 billion off their balance sheet, they recapitalised, and they've been the beneficiary post-COVID, as many legacy carriers have, where actually premium travel is buoyant. I think there's never been a better time for legacy carriers and premium cabins. I mean, it was almost like a complete reset. I mean, you've now got legacy carriers increasing the sizes of their first class. If you go back a decade, first class was, when's it going to go? And now it's almost like a complete reversal. And that's what happens, I think, when you take a whole load of capacity out of the market. The industry has probably lost sort of 5-7 years worth of growth in terms of the amount of capacity that's in there, I mean, in terms of aircraft. Plus, of course, people who've got a bit of money actually now want to spend a little bit more on experience, so premium leisure has picked up. So they've done well on that. The other thing, though, I think they've done is they've decided to be a bit more rational. They don't have a cost base that gets anywhere close to ours. So, but if you go back maybe, you know, 10 years or so, and even up to the pandemic, if we did something then they would like to match, or we better go and do what CB Pacific has done. Now I think they're more rational in terms of working out. They have a strong future, potentially, if they do it right and they focus on what's right for them. And they're going to be maybe a medium-sized network carrier, but flying long-haul with some feed from domestic feeding those long-haul routes. As for Philippine AirAsia, they're an LCC. They're part of an AirAsia group. I'm sure people know a lot about AirAsia. I won't get too much into that, but they've got their own problems. AirAsia is a company that didn't restructure in any way, shape or form during the pandemic. And it's been kicking the can down the road, and let's see how far that goes. And just to maybe talk about restructuring, one of the things that we did as CB Pacific, and as you said, I hope maybe people did know about CB. I know a number of you did. We've got a reputation, I guess, over the years that's built up where we're a strong, solid airline. And when we entered into the pandemic in 2020, we were coming off a very strong year in 2019, but it wasn't just 2019. We'd had strong years leading up to it. In fact, we were regularly one of the most profitable airlines in the world on a margin basis. We had a balance sheet, frankly, that was to die for. So when the pandemic hit, despite the fact that Southeast Asia, and in particular the Philippines, was one of the worst hit, we simply, I say it like this, we simply had too much cash. Not only simply had too much cash, but we also had so many assets that were sitting on the balance sheet. We owned so much. But it also, I mean, that was a fact, but it was also the case that we wanted to do it properly. So we stuck with everyone through the pandemic. We renegotiated things, but we didn't default on a single thing. Not a single thing did we default on. And I think that has held us true going forward, which is why, you know, when I talk to a number of the people in the leasing markets here today, I mean, it's a great position to be in, that we're a sought after credit in the lessor and the banking marketplace. Of course, we did do a restructure, and we did loads of things with a view to making us more efficient, which has helped us now as we emerge. So that's really the platform that we now have. Going forward. But in answer to your question, yeah, there's competitors out there. I think PAL's now more rational. I think they'll go and do their own thing and leave us alone. AirAsia, well, you know, you need to ask them what their plans are, but they've been talking about coming out of their PN17 for the last goodness knows how long. Let's wait and see.
The last they told me last week was July 31st is their new deadline, which I think is publicly announced as well. That's quite, yes.
By the way, Tony's done a great job there. I think it's just so complicated now, and I think the problem is there's never been a restructuring, and so something's got to happen.
Yes. You might just remind us the ownership structure of Sabu. So you alluded there to some of the restructuring that you went through. I think if I recall correctly, you're a listed company, majority owned by a family or an individual maybe. So you had no government support through the pandemic, is that right?
No, absolutely zero. Zero support through it. We had we were majority owned by JG Summit, which is a family company. It's got interests in banking, retail, FMCG. It's a very broad-based company, very successful company. And during the pandemic, there were essentially two main forms of injection of capital that came in. One, we had to do our restructuring anyway to make ourselves more efficient. That was part of selling ourselves to new investors. So the existing investors came in on convertible preference shares, but we also brought in two new key investors. One was IFC, and the other one was Indigo Partners. Now, Indigo Partners are habitual, serial investors, if you will, in LCC. So we're now a part of the Indigo Partners fold. Now, they came in on convertible bonds, both IFC and Indigo Partners. But when they convert, then they'll each have 12.5% of the company. I say when they convert, there is no way in this world that Bill Franke is a bondholder for the long term. So I can't get him to sign up and say, I'm going to convert on that day. But as sure as eggs is eggs, Indigo Partners are equity players and not bond players. So it will happen at some point.
Do they play an active role in decisions?
Yeah, no, very, very much. I mean, the Cebu Pacific is kind of, if you look at it now, and I grew up at BA and then with EasyJet, so I know how sort of a bit about UK governance, or it was a long time ago, and I'm sure it's evolved and got even better, but the governance structure in Cebu Pacific is, I would say, as good as we could have hoped it to have been at this stage. I'm sure it will get better, but we have an ExCom, we have a board, and so the three key stakeholders, JG Summit, Indigo Partners and IFC, they're present on the ExCom. But then when we have a board as well, Indigo Partners are there, IFC is there as an observer, but we have a board, independent directors and everything else. But they play a very active role. So they will, you know, any key decisions, they'll have a point of view, they will have some points of reference. They don't directly, they don't do this. I mean, you wouldn't expect them to. Their reputation is that solid, and they live to it. I don't know a deal that Wizz has got. I don't know a deal that Frontier has got, or Volaris, or JetSmart. But they will let you know if they think you've got a bad deal. So, but generally speaking, we get good deals. So, they're very active. It's good advice. I think we were doing okay-ish anyway. I think they've probably helped us up a notch. Well, no doubt they have helped us up a notch.
Well, I suppose that's why they saw the opportunity if you were doing okay before anyway. I mean, they're wise investors, let's say.
Anyone invests in airlines, I think sometimes you have to question their wisdom. I mean, or certainly over my career, I go back long enough. Although it's been a good time now. But certainly, Indigo Partners have had some very notable successes. I mean, they've had one or two failures as well in there. But overall, when you look at their portfolio, Bill and Brian and the team must have been the most successful airline investors, sort of, or up there in terms of the history of time. So super smart people. Very pleased to have them on board, and let's hope they're with us for a while. They should be.
So we might just turn back to the market and demand and how the passenger demand in the Philippines has evolved over recent years. You alluded to COVID and the travels during the pandemic earlier. How has the market evolved since then? And I'm particularly interested to hear about China, because of course pre-COVID everyone was talking about growth rates in China, the number of aircraft being delivered into China, etc. How have those sorts of passenger flows evolved for you in the past 3, 4, 5 years?
Well, the China market's a problem at the moment. If I look at, I mean, maybe let's talk about everything else, because I'm talking about it in what it's very simply. Everything else is now bigger than it was in terms of in volume. But China is the one market that hasn't come back. Now, there is a part of that that the political situation between the Philippines and China is not great. And so visas is a bit of an issue. Also, it's, you know, generally considered that China is really incentivizing its own people to spend at home as much as possible. And if you look at Chinese air travel anyway, you'll see that the domestic market is absolutely booming, but international travel is not yet caught up, or is just about getting there. And so China's the one market that we're nowhere near where we used to be. I mean, we used to be maybe 35 flights a week, and we're now at about 6 or 7. We had about 7 destinations, and we're now at 2. And it's not just us. I mean, I think that's reflective of the region overall. Probably the Philippines is the worst effect because of the political situation. But if you look at one of the consequences of that, Chinese international travel coming off, China used to provide, and still does, it's starting to come back, a lot of Sixth Freedom connectivity out of Asia generally, either going westbound into Europe and or eastbound over to the USA. And the fact that that Sixth Freedom traffic has not been there was one of the reasons why prices were up. So you were seeing yield growth on, you know, trans-Pacific stuff would have been, you know, 100-150%, both in the premium and in the economy cabins. Now that's starting to come off. So you could start to see some of those really excellent performances, and I'm not so much talking about the likes of SQ. SQ are a great airline, I mean, great airline anyway. I mean, they always have been, but they've been making record profits. And Cathay as well. But some of those other airlines that have really found profitability in recent years, some of those long haul carriers, maybe they've seen the best of the times. Once capacity starts to come back, maybe when China comes back offering connectivity, they'll start to struggle a bit. Let's see. But to be honest, it's not a game that we're in. I mean, I'm focused on that 4 hours flying around the Philippines. So,
and quite a lot of focus still domestic Philippines, as you mentioned earlier.
Oh, totally. Look, the population's growing. I mean, it's an archipelago, as I say, all those reasons. I mean, you get domestic right. When we look at strategy at CP Pacific, I don't mind sort of telling everyone this is the secret. I hope this is the secret of success. Is get the Philippines right first. I mean, it's literally concentric circles. So the first circle is drawn around the Philippines. That's where you focus your attention. The next circle is drawn at 4 hours. You know, get everything in that. We have a few outliers to that, but they have to really cross some pretty tough hurdles. And I say the main outliers have got three long-haul destinations. But to be a long-haul destination at LCC is tough. So they've got to be, I mean, Dubai is one of them, right? There's so many overseas Filipino workers in Dubai. And the market is that thick. There's room for everybody. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why it works. But not everything in the Middle East will work, for example, because it may not be thick enough and you may be coming up against some very irrational competition. So these are the things. And LCCs, without a doubt, are the most successful model, the most successful economic model in short haul, but some of the things that give it that success, they break down when you go onto long haul. I mean, in long haul, I mean, if we can improve our turn time on a 330 by 15 minutes on a 9 hour sector, it's not a lot of difference. If you can do it on a 1 hour flight, you really are going to, that's really going to generate stuff, but you're not going to get the utilization gains in long haul that you would in short haul. Plus, you've generally got bigger aircraft, you need feed. I mean, so there's a lot of reasons why it doesn't work. But anyway, anyone who, as I say, LCCs and long haul, by all means go and invest in it, but it's not a slam dunk. In short haul, it is. Well, certainly in most parts of the world. There's people in North America at the moment that will tell you the LCC is dead in short haul there, but there's probably some reasons for that.
So just looking at the other end of your fleet for a moment, the ATRs, You mentioned some of the infrastructure development that's going on. As those airports improve, do you still see a base for these airports in your fleet in the long run? Are there new airports that are coming on that will have short runways as well, for example? Or is that just a sort of tactical?
Look, a really good question. I think we have to assess as we go forward what is the long term for us in terms of investing in a turboprop fleet. Certainly for now, we see that there's enough runway, but certainly when we get there's enough scope for us for the next 5-6 years or so. When we get into the 2030s, I think then there's going to have to be an evaluation. And certainly if the fleet got to such a small scale, then you'd have to go, hang on a second, if I'm flying around with well over 100 jets, why would you want to be flying around with, say, 5 or 6 turboprops? So that maybe it's more of a distraction than a value add. But for the moment, where it's still a value add. But a good question, something that we're going to have to evaluate as we go forward.
Interesting. So just to touch on the supply chain issues that you also mentioned, I know you've been quite outspoken on this, and we hear a lot about this every day, don't we, particularly with the GTFs. How do you feel OEMs have been responding to it? And do you think we've reached the apogee of this? Do you think things are getting better now?
Is it getting better? No. Jeez. I came out of Paris. I wasn't going to go to Paris this year. The reason I went to Paris this year, we signed up something with Lufthansa Systems on technology and ops system. We signed up something with CAE on training. But it was also to see the OEMs, and it was really about all of these issues. So I've just been with Pratt. I was up with Rolls the other day up in Derby. Obviously spent time with Airbus. I think they understand it, but I'm not sure. They understand all the issues now. Have they got to the point where things are definitely improving? Not quite. I'm hoping we're at the bottom of it. We are, just to give you where we are today, we are now at 12 aircraft AOGs on our Pratt & Whitney fleet, which is as bad as it's been. As I say, I think it's gone to 13 now with what happened overnight.
So forgive me, that's 12 out of 100 aircraft.
Well, 12 out of, our NEO fleet is 41 aircraft.
Right.
So if I count 320s and 321s. So I think it's going to be 13 now. I think that could get worse next year. Now that's the challenge that we've now got with Pratt & Whitney, to make sure that that's not the case. With Rolls-Royce 27,000 is working well. They've just got to produce enough spare engines to be able to provide us for the number of engine changes we do. And Airbus have got, obviously, production issues. Everyone has got production and quality issues across the board. I mean, obviously Pratt & Whitney's, lots to talk about them, lots to talk about Boeing. Everyone's working hard on these, but it's across the board. And if you think that this industry has yet to pick itself up from all of the people we lost. And it's not just the OEMs, it's MROs, it's the airlines themselves. When we went into the depths of despair during COVID, and we didn't know quite, if we were going to survive, those people of my generation or just below, when they were offered those early retirement schemes or whatever, they said, you know, I'm off. And they took with them decades of experience. And you can't get it back. Most companies now have more staff than they had before, but they're younger staff, and their output will be less than it was, and that's absolutely the reality. Airbus is producing fewer aircraft, I think, now than it used to, and it's got more people. Now, it's getting there.
So just to talk about talent then for a moment, you mentioned that, expertise has bled away to some extent. Is it easy to find talent in the Philippines, and how do you manage that side of things?
Well, it is easy to find talent. It's getting people up the experience curve. I mean, whether it's engineers, mechanics, that's one of the big problems, right? That's one of the issues. If you've got somebody of experience in the Philippines and we train them up, and there's lots of people out of this 120 million growing population, there's lots of people come through. When they get to be good, then there are lots of people in the Middle East and other parts of the world that will come in and say, hang on a second, maybe you want a bit more money? And come and join us. So that we do get targeted, particularly for mechanics, ground handling staff. Equipment operators on ground handling are as rare as hen's teeth. I mean, you know, they're really sought after. Obviously, pilots and cabin crew as well. I'm sure a number of you fly with the Middle Eastern carriers. There will be a lot of Filipino cabin crew on board a number of those flights. Sure. And that's a testament to the Philippines' wonderful service culture, but also, you know, that they are being targeted by the carriers in the Middle East. Now, good thing on the cabin crew side, it doesn't take so long to train those up. But when you're talking about mechanics, engineers, flight crew, obviously that's a bit more of a concern. So we need to have targeted retention programs, we do, and you've got to make sure that you're a good employer in the general sense, that people want to work for you. Now, I think it does help if you're seen to be successful, you've got growth opportunities. As a former pilot myself, the idea that you can come in and you start in the right-hand seat, but there'll be advancement opportunities going to the left-hand seat because this is a growing airline, that's something that's going to be very attractive. And of course, the other thing I should say is that if you can do all that, people, they want to stay, they're very family-orientated, it's a massive family culture, they would rather stay in the Philippines. So if things are looking good for them, then they will stay. But it is a bit of a battle. We do lose people.
So perhaps one more question for me, and then we might take some questions from the floor. I'm always interested in the person behind the title. You come from an operational background. We heard a little about your background from Carl earlier. How easy do you find it to step away from that, particularly at the moment where it sounds as though some of the challenges you're facing are operational in their nature? Do you find it easy to delegate this stuff, or...?
Well, you best ask my COO what he thinks. You have to step away from it. I mean, but I think it does help. The biggest single challenge at the moment for, I think, most airline CEOs is keeping the fleet flying. It has never been more difficult. And I mean, it's not about safety, but it's about keeping them maintained. Of course, if you haven't got the parts because of the supply chain issue, then of course they won't fly. So it's not a safety issue in that sense. It's just keeping the number of aircraft flying that you think you've got. We do fleet management 3 times a week. I mean, I remember at BA we used to do it a couple of times a year, probably. I don't know, something like that. I mean, but you have to review on a regular basis what your aircraft availability is going to be for the two weeks coming up, and then extend that out further. But am I very operational? I've probably got more operational on the fleet issues in the last year and a half than I had done previously. But I do try and step back. I do get involved in the other stuff, and I do let my COO breathe. But I think it helps in this environment if you've got an understanding of the operation. Or if you're a CEO that doesn't, then you need very good operations people, and particularly, I would say, engineering and maintenance people. That's probably the... I mean, it's always been the toughest job. As a former pilot, you'd always sort of say, hey, the pilot's the be-all and the end-all. But I find the most difficult job that I think is in the airline is in engineering and maintenance. It's the most complicated out of them all. And I'm sure a lot of people in the lessor community here would possibly agree. The aircraft are complicated things. And keeping them flying has never been more difficult. But anyway, yeah, I do get involved in the operation, but... with the exception of my COO sending me a few messages, I do try and take a bit of time off as well.
And out of interest, do you still fly? Do you keep your license?
No, occasionally they'll throw me in a simulator, just if I'm going around the simulator place, they'll say, well, here you are, go and do a circuit or something on the 320 or whatever. I can just about remember to do it, but it's better for everyone that I stay doing what I do.
Very good. Well, thank you for answering my questions. I'm sorry there weren't more about sport. Perhaps now we can take some from... John, you're nearby, so I should
First of all, thanks for coming back to London to speak today. I've got one on the industry and one on sport. At least the one on sport is multiple choice. On the industry, I was going to ask about the GTFs, but you've answered it. So a lot of airlines we speak to at Sky now are saying... don't want to lease anymore, did a lot of that, want to own, and they're looking at finance leases. So I'm wondering if that's the same trend that you're employing at Sabre. And on sport, your multiple choice question is, what do you think will happen, what do you think needs to happen for England to bring back the Ashes and or bring back the World Cup next summer? That would be football/soccer.
All right, just on the cricket, I'm in my bucket list, although I did it 2017, but I'm doing it again this year. I'll be there at Melbourne for the Boxing Day Test. If you haven't done it, walking down to the MCG on Boxing Day morning, it's just great. 100,000 people wandering down to the centre of Melbourne. Anyway, back to the ownership question. So we at Secret Pacific, we were always more owned. If we go back to pre-pandemic years, the majority of our aircraft were owned. And that was one of the things we were able to monetize when we owned the pandemic. We were able to do a number of sale and leasebacks. So at the moment, we've got more operating leases than as a percentage than we have finance. But now most of our transactions are going to edge towards the finance lease. I mean, we do a lot of JOLCOs, as you know. So, I mean, JOLCOs, it's great to have access to the market. We're one of only 20 airlines in the world that accesses the JOLCO market. We had JOLCOs before the pandemic, and we maintained them. Everything there, its reputation is everything there. And so we've got lots of opportunities still to do that. And JOLCOs are absolutely the cheapest way of financing us, as we see it at the moment. Plus, we can do Japanese equity as well. We're now the largest carrier between the Philippines and Japan. So we've got a lot of income, revenue that comes in yen. So we're naturally hedged against any exposure there. But yeah, I think more and more people are looking at finance. Particularly, some of the airlines now are finding they're a bit more flush than they used to be historically. So I think that's one of the reasons why they're thinking like that.
Thank you for your words. I'm Kuzbari from Novus. Two questions, one on industry and one on Philippines. Industry, you recently done a deal with Flyadeal for some, strategic cooperation, including some wet lease. Is that a one-off, or is that more of a potential, future, new business model for Cebu? Philippines, as you said, it's a phenomenal country, huge changes. Not only do they have a lot of staff in the Middle East, but a lot of construction workers in the Middle East and elsewhere are Filipino. I think the majority, sailors-wise, the biggest country, representative in the sailors are Filipino. But as you said, that the country is now changing and growing domestically, do you see that changing potentially and affecting VFR and other transport, or will just change from one transport, reason to another? And how do you see that evolving?
Okay, so let's do the one about the Philippines first. So I do think you will start to see some of the younger generation that used to go abroad for opportunities. Some of those will stay in country. So I think you will start to see that. I don't think it will stop the OFWs going out there, the sailors, the cabin crew, the construction workers, the maids. So they will still be there. But I think what you'll see with the brighter young generation, well-educated, there's opportunity for good jobs in the Philippines. Now, them staying there, I think, is a good thing. That, I think, will help drive the economy. So I do think a slight change, but more about some of the really bright younger people will stay at home. Now, if I go back to the Flyadeal question. So the Flyadeal, Stephen Greenway is the CEO, actually. We were already looking at something, but the conversation or the activity that we're doing with Flyadeal came out of a conversation. Stephen and his team came over because they wanted to talk to us about our A330neo. It was before they announced their own A330neo order. They wanted to understand how we operated it, high density, etc. And then while we were chatting, it became obvious that his off-peak season is our high peak, and our high peak is his off-peak. And in the Philippines, and even pre-COVID, when we were, generally were very successful in the years running up to the pandemic, there were what we call the Janus months. So it's June, July, August, November, and October, September. Jason months, I should say, Jason months. And those months are off-season. And so Q3 is a bad quarter. So in 2019, we had a super result. We broke even in Q3, which was really good. But as we grow,
we're close to 100 aircraft now. As we grow, we're not going to be able to manage in that off-peak season by just profiling our maintenance. We're going to have too much capacity. I mean, we're fine because we'll make money in the other three quarters, but if we want to improve our profitability even more, how can we reduce our losses in Q3? So is there something we can do with our aircraft in Q3? Now, Q3 for us, it's not only is Q3 our off, peak season for Stephen Greenway in Flydo. Actually, Q3 is peak season for just about everywhere else in the world, here, for example. So we'd already decided that we were going to start looking at wet lease to say, how can we manage our off-peak capacity? And we don't yet have all the regulatory approvals to do it in Europe, but we can do it close to home and in the Middle East. So this is us dipping our toes. So it's currently two A320ceos, currently flying around domestically within the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It's, you know, Turfwood is doing really well. And we see that going forward, we will expand on the amount of wet lease capacity we put out in Q3. Because it's a good way of managing our assets. It's not to make loads of money, it's actually to reduce losses. And that's effectively what it's about. Now, in terms of what else we might do with Stephen Greenway, where there's other forms of cooperation we can look at, if ever we decided that to go back into the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia as one of our long-haul routes, we've currently got three, let's say we added that one back in, if we were to do that, having a partner in that part of the world helping us sell, you know, potential things like code shares, all those sort of things, those are things that we could look at. So there is no limit to the things that we can talk about, but for now it appears to be a very successful wet lease cooperation.
Alan Drummond from Air Transport World. A couple of questions. Your director of network planning said earlier this year, although as you say you're very focused on the 4-hour radius, she said that they were actively looking at a 9-hour flight envelope. I'm just wondering what progress has been with that. And secondly, how are the A330neos performing both in terms of load factor and engines?
Yeah, so that would have been Angela. I think she was down, was it in Australia, I think?
Yeah.
I got a message from Brian Frankie. He sort of said, well, your network planning sort of say we're going to fly lots of 9-hour sectors. I said, don't worry, it was just, specifically there's one route that we're looking at. Yeah, so as I say, if I go forward 5 years from where we are now, we've currently got three long-haul routes. I would guess we might get to 4 or 5. I mean, so there may be 1 or 2 that we'll add in, but it's not the core of our business. Those A330neos, they really are short-haul buses. So they're really for, I mean, we do them a lot into Japan, Bangkok. I mean, basically the big metropolises around the region, but we also use them domestically. So Manila, Cebu, Manila, Davao. I mean, just to put it into context, the route's got to be thick, right? The route has to be thick, but there is not, from a cost point of view, this aircraft has the lowest unit seat costs of any other commercial aircraft out there, period. Now, you've got to fit it. I mean, that's pointless sort of flying around fresh air, just saying, oh, I've got low costs. I mean, you do need to get revenue, but if you put it on a thick route, it's absolutely fantastic. Now, in terms of how it's performing, we love the product. I think in terms of the engines, I think the Trent 7000 is a really good engine. I don't think it's had the problems, obviously, that the Trent 1000 has had. And so that's doing well. The issue for us is we burn through the cycles quite quickly because we operate the aircraft on relatively short sectors. So we have to change the engines more frequently than anybody else. And so Rolls has got the same materials issues that are affecting the engine. You know, can it get the materials to be able to do the overhauls, to be able to produce the engine on time? So our issue is getting the spare engines to come in to support us as we're doing our engine change plan, which is something we're going through at the moment. So again, I was up with Rolls earlier this week, and that was specifically to talk about what we call the line of balance in terms of how is the spare engines, your engine situation looking. So we were looking at over the next 12 to 18 months. So that we're actively managing that. And Rolls are doing, I think, have done a pretty good job in terms of getting stuff through their shops, perhaps more so than others.
Mike, Max Kingsley-Jones from Sirium. Firstly, thanks for mentioning Stephen Greenway, because he's speaking to the club in November, so we can check in with him then. Two questions, actually. One, you're very focused on 4 hours. but you were a launch customer back in 2019 for the A321XLR. Do you still have those commitments, and so where will they be deployed? Second question was more about the recovery. So where do you, how does your fleet capacity compare with December 2019, if we take that as the proxy for the start of COVID, in terms of where are you today, and how much of that difference, whatever it is driven by demand, driven by supply of aircraft from the OEMs, and or supply of fleet availability?
So I'll take those in reverse order, if I may. Let's just talk about where we are in terms of overall capacity. So at the end of last year, we were bigger than we were in 2019. So we flown, last year was 24.5 million pax, in 2019 was 22.5. So by the end of the year, we were on a run rate well ahead of where we were in 2019. As we came into this year, so Q1, we grew, in fact, I'll give you the year-to-date for May. Pax were up about 26% on about a 25% seat growth. So some of that would have been upgauging, but some of, obviously some of that's fleet. Now, if you'd asked me 4 months ago, I'd have said that through this year we'd have been about 25% seat growth through the year, because we've invested to take advantage, I think, of the opportunity. One, where we think the Philippines is good, we think demand in the Philippines is good, and the region is strong for what we do. Plus, our direct competitors couldn't grow like we were. In fact, they're smaller than they used to be. So that's the reason why we did it. Our growth is going to come off slightly. So if you ask me for the full year, we're now saying somewhere between 15 and 20%, and that is actually fleet driven. So whereas 3 or 4 months ago, I would have considered that our AOGs on Pratt & Whitney, which I said is now 12, probably 13 now, was going to come down towards the end of this year. I don't think it's going to come down as much as we thought. So our growth rate through this year is going to still be high, but it's going to come off from where we were. So does that answer your first question in terms of how much we've grown? And
yeah, just also in terms of deliveries, are you getting the aircraft at the rate you expect, or is that also affecting
growth? Yeah, there are delays. I mean, but we will take 7 new deliveries this year. And we've got another 7, I think, next year. And then there's probably about the same again. And then it's 2029 when we get into the new order, which is the... I say it's up to 152, it's 70 firm plus a whole load of options, but the more and more we look at that now, it's almost certainly going to be towards the 152 level. The reason we did that, by the way, is one of the things of new capacity in the Philippines is there is a new runway or a new airport that's going to come to Manila. At the moment, you've got Naia in Manila, which is slot constrained. It's improving, by the way. It's been privatized, so the operation is improving there. But there's a new facility that's going to come online. Now, the question is it going to arrive in 28, 29, or 2030? And we don't know. So we need, within our order, we've got lots of flexibility. And when we first did the order, we weren't sure it was going to arrive. We're now sure it's going to arrive. Now, when that airport arrives, it's not like we're going to put one aircraft in there. We almost need a brand new fleet to put in there, because we're not going to remove the aircraft that are in the existing airport and suddenly say, I'm going to ship those out over to the new one, because these airports will operate in tandem. It'll be a bit like Heathrow and Gatwick, or the one I refer to is Haneda and Narita. The existing airport is really Haneda, and you haven't seen anybody giving up a slot in Haneda. If they were, then I'd be jumping on it straight away. Now, your second question, sorry, I waffled on for so long there. I forgot your second, or your first bit of your question.
XLR, you were launched.
Oh, yeah, XLR.
How does that fit into the network?
Yeah, within all our A320 family orders, we've got complete flexibility. So we can go from XLRs to LRs to 320s to 321s. So we've got complete flexibility. When we did the announcement, let's be upfront about this, this was done when we did the A330neo order in Paris in 2019. And it was an order of, we also, along with the 330neos, we had 15 A320 family aircraft. And there was a keenness, I think, to make an announcement, I'm not saying so much from us, but to advertise, let's say, the XLR, because it you know, was just establishing itself. So we said including 10 XLRs, but we've always had the optionality to move away from that. I don't think we will be an XLR operator. I don't think that is an aircraft for us. But we've got, as I know, we've got complete flexibility with that. I'd love to be an all A321neo operator, let me be clear. If the infrastructure was there, if the slots were there, I would love to be all A321neo operators. Although I do have a particular affection for the 330neo because I just think it's just a great big bus. And as I say, the economics of that on a thick route is astonishing.
Any further questions? In that case, Mike, I'll say thank you very much for speaking to us yesterday.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you, James. You're worse than a Japanese leasing company, BBC, when we call them, don't we? I can then answer a question from John about the cricket. Who's going to win it? For you. As an argument, I'll say Australia.
We need a few colours.
We need a few colours, okay. Right. Just quickly, I'll do the voting. Well, before I do that, I should make some announcements. Well, Max, you beat me to it. Steve Miller-Raise and Lead Speaker at the Club in November. We have Steve Harsey in September, which we're doing in association with big conferences down in Westminster. We'll have a room of about 200, so Steve has been a great support of the club. We'll be speaking then. And if Donald, the orange one, speaks long enough, LAL CEO will be our speaker at Christmas. We mentioned before earlier on, I think somebody mentioned, our next one of events is in September. There's still a couple of seats available. They've been very successful. The first one's about 200, and I think we've got 130 already booked in for this one. And that's from September 3rd. The details are on the website. And it's all got to do with the supply chain issues. Touched on actually keeping aircraft flying, maintenance of aircraft issues, and that's at the